So Tashi Dele, your homeliness, and Tashi Dele to everyone here, to our esteemed Buddhist colleagues, scientists, students, scholars, and interested visitors. Welcome to the third and final day of this first Emory-Tibet Symposium, Bridging Buddhism and Science for Mutual Enrichment. So this session is going to be about neuroscience. It's titled, it's a big title, What is Mind and Its Relationship to the Body, Brain, and Subjective Experience? And we'll be hearing from four speakers this morning. First of all is Christoph Koch, who is the head of the Allen Institute for Brain Science. After having been a distinguished faculty at Caltech for over a quarter century, he's famous for his work on the visual system, but particularly for his pioneering work on consciousness, and that's what he's going to be talking to us about today. Next, we'll hear from Lodo Songpo, who's at Gaden Jangse, and he comes from Kham originally and has been involved in science studies for over 10 years. Including as a Tenzin Gyatso science scholar in the first cohort at Emory University, where he graduated after 3 years. He's now science coordinator at the Gaden Jangse Monastery. And then third, we'll hear from Ryan Dias, assistant professor at Emory University in psychiatry. He comes from India originally. Took his master's at Tata Institute for Fundamental Research, then went to the United States, where he's been looking at genetic bases of behavior, and in that context went on to look at the epigenetic environmental effects on behavior. So he's one of the leading scholars in that area. And then lastly, we'll hear from Gelug Jaltsen, who is also from Kham. He's at Drepung Loseling. He also has spent over 10 years studying science and was in the first cohort also of Emory Tibet students, including a Tenzin Gyatso science scholar. He graduated also from Emory, and he's now teaching science at Drepung. And the only thing I would say to conclude this introduction is that I think it's really representative of science how diverse this group is. They have come from so many different places through such complicated paths to arrive here today. So first we're going to be hearing from Christoph Koch, who'll be talking about consciousness.
Thank you, Carol. It's a great honor and a privilege, Your Holiness, to present 2,400 years of Western thought and scientific Western thought about consciousness to you in 20 minutes. I'll try to do my best. So I will start with the most important philosopher for consciousness and also the father of one of the fathers of Western science, which is René Descartes, who wrote a series of books in the early 16th century when he was living in Holland, where he made a very famous statement. He made it first in Latin and then in French. And in English, translated, it means, I'm conscious, therefore I am. So he took this point of view, how do I know anything exists? And finally, the only reason I have to suppose that something exists is that I'm conscious. I can doubt that there's a world outside. I can doubt that I have a body, but I cannot doubt that I have mind, that I have consciousness. So the only reason I know I exist is because I'm conscious. And so even if I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm jet lagged, I don't know who I am, I don't know where I am because my brain is still fuzzy, but I wake up in the middle of the night in a dark room, that's what I experience. I already experienced something. And this is the central fact of my existence. And this comes prior to knowing anything about physics. This comes prior to knowing about stars and people and dogs and trees. And so we say phenomenology comes prior to physics. So Science until recently, until 30 or 40 years ago, Western science, particularly neuroscience, did not deal at all with consciousness. So you could open a textbook about neuroscience, about the brain, and you would you can read over 1,000 pages facts about molecules and synapses and neurotransmitter, but nobody ever said how it feels like something to be an owner of a brain. That the brain actually has an interior point of view. It looks at the world. It has experiences. So it's okay if physicists write textbooks about stars and elementary particle without mentioning experience. But how can you have how can you talk about neuroscience without talking about the central fact of neuroscience that the object that we study generates consciousness? Now this is slowly beginning to change in the West. So now consciousness is a legitimate topic of scientific discussions, mm-hmm. and you can make a career and you can write grants about it and you can write books and papers on it. So this is just another experience. This is a famous physicist, Ernst Mach, who wanted to describe how the world looks. So he is a so-called phenomenologist, and you can see maybe on the right, you can see his nose, right? So he's looking out at the world, and he sees his body, he sees his nose, he sees the top of his eyebrows, and he looks out at the world. And the challenge for us as scientists is to describe how this view of the world comes into being, because nothing in the facts of the brain from the outside, that the brain is a physical system like any other physical system, and nothing right now tells us that the brain has these mental properties. So this is a mental property, and it's very mysterious for us as scientists, how do mental properties come to physical properties? We know about physical properties more and more. This is what Chris described yesterday in physics. But then it comes as a total surprise to be told, well, in addition to these physical properties, it also, you have a point of view. It feels like something. This is the modern term. It feels like something to be the owner of a brain that gives rise to mind. And the question is, how does this happen? So today, consciousness, by and large, in the West, is equated with experience. So to be conscious is to have an experience. That is the key defining feature of consciousness. It feels like something to see. So these includes external sensory consciousness, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling. It includes also higher order consciousness like hearing, you know, imagining, I can hear my mother's voice, I can dream of her. It also includes memory. I distinctly remember when I was last here and when I was here 4 years ago and talking to Your Holiness, so that's 4 years earlier. I can also have internal perception. I can have a perception of my body being cold or warm or sweat or hungry, or I can be in love or I can be anger. Those are all different conscious experiences. Common to them all, including self-consciousness, so the fact that I know I'm conscious, I know I'm a man, I know I will die one day, those are just different aspects of consciousness. And then there are these very subtle experiences that Buddhism focus on, flow, joy, contentment, and peacefulness. Again, common to all of them is that it feels like something to have that experience. And so the challenge for all of them is to understand how the point of view emerges from physics, from physical properties that we study every day in the lab. So consciousness is identical to having an experience. Each experience, the way we think about them, has a content. The content can be I see a face, I hear a voice, I'm angry. Those are three different contents. And it feels like something to have that particular content. Now, it may be possible, some people are speculating, that under certain conditions, maybe you can be conscious without being conscious of anything in particular. And that's very interesting for us as a neuroscientist, because what it would mean at the level of the brain to be conscious, that means you're not asleep, you're not dreaming, you're conscious, but you're not conscious of anything in particular. Sort of like naked awareness. Now, this is a beautiful illusion. If Your Holiness, if you can fixate the cross in the center, and don't move your eyes at all. Try to keep your eyes as steady as you can. And if you really keep your eyes steady, that doesn't work quite.
It's okay.
Now look what you see, and look what's actually there. So what's really there are these magenta circles and a hole, right? But what you see, let's go back. What you see is a green disc that travels. Right, but the green disc is actually not there. There's no green disc. All there is a hole that travels. And instead of seeing the hole, you see a green disc. So I show this illusion. And another aspect of this illusion is that if you really keep your eyes steady, the magenta disc will all disappear. The only thing you see is a green disc moving around. I show this illusion because it's a beautiful illustration that our conscious experience can be very incorrect, what we see out there. So here in the limit, you only see a single green disc traveling, which isn't really out there. So sensory perception can be fault, may not be an accurate representation what is out there. Okay, for us, one of the biggest questions, this is one of the biggest differences I found between your way or the Buddhist way of thinking about consciousness and our way of thinking about consciousness from a scientific point of view. We, because I think René Descartes and then Christianity, for hundreds of years, we believed in human exceptionalism, that only we, humans, consciousness. So today, as scientists, there's great skepticism about who else has conscious. And the default assumption is that nobody except us has consciousness. And it's only slowly over the last 100 years that people, more and more people are beginning to accept the possibility that other organisms are also conscious. But we still, this is something we discuss at every single meeting. So ultimately, of course, only I know about my own conscious. I don't know about your consciousness. Now, I assume you're conscious. Why? Well, because you can describe what you see, and what you see is similar to what I describe, and your brain is very similar, and were you to undergo an fMRI study, a brain scanner study, I would see a brain in your head that operates very similar to my brain. So I assume you are also conscious. And so we can use this now, we can use this assumption to do a lot of tests. Because now I can put Your Holiness in a magnetic scanner, and I can study how does your brain respond when you have a conscious experience, and I can put EEG electrodes on your skull, and I can see what sort of brain waves do you have when you're conscious as compared to when you're not conscious. Now, we focus on the brain. This is a modern phenomena. This arose only in the 17th century. Until the 17th century, we were completely dominated by cardiac thinking. And even today, all the imagery in the West is for some Christian imagery, you know, you have a bleeding heart of Jesus Christ. You don't have a bleeding brain of Jesus Christ. You have a church called,
Immaculate Heart.
Immaculate Heart Church. You don't have an Immaculate Brain Church. Or I love you with all my heart. Or I give my sweetheart, my wife, for Valentine's, I gave her a heart-shaped chocolate. Mm-hmm. I should really be giving her a brain-shaped chocolate, but I don't, because we still have this this heart-based language. But we now know, partly we know this from heart transplantation. If my heart gets transplanted, I get a new heart, I'm still me, I'm still Christoph. My memories are not in my heart, my memories are in my brain. So we know it's a brain that gives rise to consciousness. And so now I can do studies, so I can go inside and back, this is my brain, and I can I can look at something and I can see where the different bits and pieces of my brain that are specifically responsible for conscious experience. And so over the last 100 years, we've learned a lot about the brain and how it relates to consciousness. One of the most insight investigation is almost 100 years old. There was a terrible sickness that swept around the world during World War I and after World War I. It's called the sleeping sickness, encephalica lethargica. And millions of people were affected, and the people who were affected fell into a profound sleep. They slept 20 or more hours a day, and they couldn't be aroused. A small subset could never go to sleep and was hypervigilant. Many died of this disease. It's an infection of the brain. And then this clinician, von Economou, discovered that what gets affected by the disease are two parts in the brain that are specifically responsible for promoting consciousness and for promoting sleep and awake. So ever since him, we now know that sleep is an active state and that there's a switch that has to be turned on in order for me to be conscious. So it's just like my heart has to operate in order to get blood through my brain, but also in terms of brainstem, there are neurons in the brainstem, in the part of the brain and the lower stem, that have to be active for me to be conscious. But they don't themselves generate conscious experience, but they have to be present in order and for there to be conscious. So now what the modern search for what people call the neuronal correlates of consciousness is, the idea is I'm looking at something like that scene with a dog, and I like to identify what are the specific mechanisms in my brain that give rise to that conscious experience compared to when I don't see the dog. Is it a particular type of nerve cells? Are they located in a particular type of brain? How does it differ when I see something versus when I imagine the dog, or when I dream about my dog, or when I smell a dog, or when I'm upset? What is the commonality among all these different mechanisms that give rise to consciousness? Because we care a lot about mechanisms, and so we're interested, what are the specific mechanisms that give rise to any one conscious experience? And so we have sophisticated techniques. This is, for example, one technique. You're looking at the picture on the left, and you can sort of see a face, right? Now, when I briefly flash this image, sometimes you can see a face, and then you push a button, yes, I see a face. And sometimes you don't see a face. The image is always the same, but because it's flashed so briefly, only sometimes do I have a conscious experience of a face, and sometimes I don't see. All I see is noise. And so I can now look at the difference in your brain to try to identify where the specific areas in the brain that are associated with having the conscious experience of a face. And this is what many labs do now. Why? Well, because we'd like to look at what is it about the specific, which bits and pieces of the brain give rise to consciousness. We know this is a remarkable finding. So this is a patient who has a big hole in her brain. She lacks the part of the brain called the cerebellum. You know, there's a little brain at the back of the brain. In fact, 69 billion of your 86 billion neurons are in this little brain called the cerebellum. More than 4 to 5 neurons in your brain are here. If you're not born with them, early on you have more difficult to learn, early on you have more difficult to speak, but once you're adult, it's very difficult to tell the difference from a normal person, and this person doesn't complain. She has perfectly normal consciousness. And we also know from other cases when you have a stroke in the cerebellum or when it has to be operated upon that the cerebellum does not give rise to conscious sensation. So this is very interesting if you care about mechanisms, because it says, well, those are neurons. They have all the electrical activity you expect of a neuron. And so this just shows the question in stark relief. What is it about those neurons in the cerebellum that does not give rise to conscious experience, but other neurons do? Okay, so we've now we have identified. I'm not going to go in detail here through a variety of different techniques. The part of the brain that needs to be active in order for there to be conscious experience is the part of the cerebral cortex, of the neocortex. Not everything in neocortex, but only certain parts of cortex, of the neurons here in roughly this part of the brain. This is exciting because now it's like hunting. It's like hunting. We're trying to hunt for the sources of consciousness in the brain. We're trying to smell it, and we're trying to hunt it using all sorts of different techniques. Why is it these neurons but not those? Do they look different? Do they have different connectivity? This is what we're trying to find out now. So for us, it's very interesting to investigate using objective scientific measures who else has consciousness. What about patients that I can't talk to anymore, that are in coma because they have a brain damage, or that are in a persistent vegetative state? Are they conscious or not? Is there anybody home? We believe if your EEG is flat, if your brain, if your cortex has no more electrical activity, that you're not conscious. You're alive, but you're not conscious. But there are some patients that maybe sometimes have an EEG, or it's very irregular, and we are not sure, is there anybody home or not? And it's very important for us and for their loved one to know, is the patient alive but not conscious, or does it feel like something to be a patient? We're interested in babies that can't talk yet. To what extent is a baby conscious? We believe a baby is conscious because the baby can do complex things like imitation learning. So you can do something like this to the baby, and the baby will do something like this back. So we believe that a baby has some type of consciousness. So these are patients, like this is a very famous patient, Terry Schiavo, who was for 14 years in a state where we were not sure whether she was conscious or not. Most scientists believe she was not conscious, but she was alive. And so we try to find more objective ways of testing that. And then finally, we come to animals. So I believe that animals are conscious, certainly that mammals are conscious. So here you see dogs interacting with humans. You can see dogs that behave very much like humans. So here's a dog who's looking at the owner eating a hamburger, and then the owner didn't give him the last bit of the hamburger, and the dog is surprised. How could you not give me the last piece of hamburger? It's the same response that humans would have. So for reasons like this, most biologists now are willing to accept that certainly mammals are conscious, mammals that have a neocortex, and we can study them in the laboratory. But there are many systems where we are simply not sure whether they're conscious and when does consciousness happen. So, for example, in a fetus, we mentioned this already yesterday, when does consciousness first arise? Is it at the moment of conception? Is it when you're actually born? There's some evidence that the baby is actually asleep in the womb and it's only conscious when it exits the mother womb. We don't know. What about their special type of experience like near-death experiences? Is that truly a conscious experience or not? People are investigating that. There are these special cases. This is a case of two girls, little girls. Their heads are grown together. They're Siamese twins. And their heads seem to be merged. Their brains seem to be merged at the level of thalamus. So do they have one conscious mind, or do they have two separate conscious minds? It's a very interesting question. We don't know. What about special states like sleepwalking? You know, sometimes people can walk in their sleep. Are they conscious or not? We're not sure. Probably not, but we're not sure. What about the animals that are very, very different from us? So this is a bee. The brain of a bee, as you mentioned yesterday, Your Holiness, is the bee of an insect is much, much, much smaller than ours, but it's very complex. Its numbers of neurons is 10 times its density, its circuitry is 10 times more complicated than the circuitry here. So why do we assume that a bee is not conscious, like almost everybody in the West does? What about group mind? it's a question that people have asked since hundreds of years. Does it feel like, is there some sort of mind above and beyond the mind of you and me and Carol and everybody else? Is there some sort of Emery Tibetan group mind? So we are, of course, very interested in the question. And then lastly, the question that we discuss a lot now in the West, what about computers that talk? What about cars that have complicated behavior, that can drive themselves, that have sensors, that have motors, that can do planning? If a patient could do everything like one of those cars could do, you would definitely say the patient is conscious. So on the basis of what grounds can we say that car is not conscious? So in summary, we believe that consciousness is associated with certain physical activity in the most complex piece of highly organized matter in the universe, the human neocortex or neocortex in general. We don't yet understand the exact condition that give rise to consciousness. What are the mechanistic conditions, purely at the mechanistic level? What are the mechanistic physical reasons for a system to be conscious? When is this system conscious and when is it not conscious? We do know there's much conscious activity that's not conscious, like in the cerebellum, my liver, my heart, my kidney. All those are complicated physical systems and they don't give rise to consciousness. Why? We believe that it's very likely that the same thing occurs in other mammals. We don't know about other species. And right now we have no idea to what extent consciousness extends across all the animal kingdom or across all of biology. We simply don't know. And then the last slide is the challenges that we are facing now in the West is that nothing in our materialistic worldview prepares us for mental properties. This is a big challenge for us and has always been. And so we don't believe in a pure dualism anymore. We don't believe in an independent soul that's sort of extra natural, a supernatural. So, but we still have to explain how consciousness arises, how the mental arises from the physical. And I think ultimately my intuition is that we have to change the notion of materialism to get closer to what sort of what could be called panpsychism or pan-experientialism. The idea that matter, that certain types of matter in highly complex systems comes hand in hand with mental property, that physical property and mental property can co-occur, and that consciousness ultimately is matter viewed from the inside. Physics studies the relationship among material objects, and consciousness is how material objects feel from the inside. And that is an ongoing project that we in the West, philosophers and scientists like myself, are pursuing now. And with that, I thank you for your consciousness and your attention.
If you can change this loader around. Well, while Lodo Tsangpo is taking his seat, in case we didn't notice already from Christoph's presentation, consciousness is considered the hard problem. Yes. Yeah. And so you can see why neuroscientists are so interested in communicating with Tibetan Buddhist scholars, because you have made a study of a deep, deep study of this. So maybe you can help us with the hard problem. So in that vein, Tsangpo, if you could.
This one. Good morning, Your Holiness. First, I want to pay my deepest respect to Your Holiness, to Venerable Masters, Honorable Si Kyung, and Speaker of the Parliament, and distinguished professors, scientists, and all the audience. My presentation is about consciousness from Buddhist point of view. I have categorized this topic into five sections. First, the attributes of the mind. Second, difference between sensory and mental consciousness. Third, difference between gross and subtle mind. Fourth, difference between mind and mental factors or mental event. Fifth, difference between purpose of carrying out analysis of the mind. I'm not going to talk detail of each of these, but I will share a few main points of these sections and leave the rest for the panel discussion. Before diving into my presentation, I think it is important to make clear distinction between the term that we use, consciousness, in English, and namshi in Tibetan. I think by listening to Christopher's wonderful presentation, it is very clear that consciousness has less range of application than the namshi in Tibetan. Because namshi, it does not only include conscious experience, but also unconscious entities. I think this is important to keep in mind because my presentation is mainly focused on namshi rather than consciousness per se. To talk about the attributes of the mind, I think it can be talked within three aspects. First, causal aspect. Second, entity aspect. Third, experiential aspect. For the causal aspect, in the previous and past presentations, we have heard about talking these two causes, which are substantial cause and contributory cause or cooperative causes. This is quite important here to understand the difference between these two causes. So I'm going to give a simple example to explain the difference between of these two causes. If I take an example of a clay pot, the substance or stuff that turns into clay itself is considered as its substantial cause. And all other factors that contributed to make the clay pot exists are considered as its contributory cause. And for this concept, I have a quote by Acharya Dhammakriti which says that which is not a consciousness itself cannot be substantial cause to another consciousness. The reason why I brought these two causes here is because since the consciousness is very different from physical entities by its nature, the substantial cause of consciousness should necessarily be a prior moment of consciousness. Every consciousness is a continuum of its previous consciousness, and if we trace the origin of it, then we might say it is beginningless. To talk about how consciousness is different from physical entity, I need to talk about the entity aspects of the consciousness. Entity aspect of consciousness also can be talked with three properties. The property of luminous, the property of being aware, conscious, the property of being unobstructive. The property of being luminous, there is three different interpretation. The first, there are three different interpretations. First, the consciousness is luminous because it is free of all the physical composites and physical particles. Second, it is luminous because its fundamental nature is not affected by afflictive emotions. Or another way to say is all the afflictive emotions are not embedded in the nature of consciousness. This is the key reason why we believe mind and consciousness has a potential for limitless development. On the other hand, physical training development is always limited. it cannot go beyond, the physical training development cannot go beyond the fundamental constraint that is imposed by nature and its constitution of the body. On the other hand, for the case of consciousness, its obstacles are removable, temporary. That's why we believe all the living beings, including animals, have a potential to be enlightened being or to attain Buddhahood. Third interpretation is that the consciousness is luminous because it is a reflective of any object. It can have a reflection of any object. And for that, I have another quote by Acharya Dhammakriti. Therefore, my own mind is luminous by virtue of its own nature of luminosity, by virtue of other objects being transferred and eliminated in it. This makes it too luminous. This makes it luminous too. To talk about the property of being aware, consciousness, being aware or conscious, refer to ability to know something, to apprehend something, to cognize something, and this is the fundamental function of consciousness. And here I have another quote, but I'm going to skip it. And to talk about the experiential aspect, the experiential aspect of consciousness can be talked within the two modes of consciousness. The consciousness that experiences the object and the consciousness itself experienced by another type of consciousness. The fact that we remember something is the result of having experience of that object in the past. Otherwise, we cannot have that kind of remembrance. And for this concept, actually, there is a debate between Madhyamaka point of view and Chittamandika point of view. Madhyamaka point of view, this doesn't have to be the case to experience something. Everything that I have presented so far are the attributes of consciousness. Now I'm going to talk about difference between sensory consciousness and mental consciousness. The unique condition or determined condition or characteristics that makes sensory consciousness very distinctive from mental consciousness is that all the sensory consciousness depend on physical sense power. In addition to that, to give arise any kind of sensory consciousness, it has to have a direct contact with the object that is being perceived by it. And it is the same case to the pleasure that is directly driven by sensory consciousness. Therefore, if we depend on or indulge into too much sensory pleasures, then we cannot get long-lasting pleasure and genuine happiness. As long as the material that stimulates, triggers the sense of pleasure is there, or happiness remains there, or happiness lasts there, we can have our happiness. But pleasure, once that substance starts to degrade, then our happiness or pleasure starts to disappear. On the other hand, if we train our mind over the time with the proper technique, then our happiness will not depend on outside material resources. It doesn't matter in what condition you are or we are, we can be stronger, we can be more happier. And another ways of differentiating these two, the sensory consciousness and mental consciousness, is that whether the object appears lucidly or not. Whether object appear lucidly or not. To explain this, one simple example is that when we touch a cup of hot water with your bare hand, this is like having sensory experience. But if you touch the same cup with covering slim cloth, and this is kind of having a mental consciousness, there's a difference between there is a qualitative differences between sensory experience and mental experience. And another way of making difference between these two is based on whether or not it is based on whether or not phenomena of all the three time appears to it. For the mental consciousness, it can have an appearance of three time events, past, present, future. But for the sensory consciousness, they cannot. And another, I think the fourth one is pretty much same as what I said, so I'm just going to skip that. And now I'm going to talk about difference between gross and subtle mind. Gross and subtle mind, and there are several bases where we can rely upon to make a distinction between gross and subtle mind. If you make a distinction based on how hard or easy it is to identify, then we will say feeling of pleasure and suffering is grosser in relative to neutral feeling, because the sense of pleasure and suffering is more easier, more obvious as to identify. And if we make the differences based on whether it relies on a physical sense power or not, then we would say sensory consciousness are more grosser in relative to mental consciousness, because mental consciousness does not depend on physical sense power. Third, if you make a distinction based on the clarity or vagueness of its focal object and representational aspect, then we can see the difference within the mental consciousness itself. The mental consciousness during the awake is more grosser in respect to the consciousness of dream, and dreamy consciousness is more grosser in respect to deep sleep consciousness. And actually, I think His Holiness Dalai Lama spoke about these on the first day of this symposium. And the subtlest consciousness that we can ever experience during the lifetime is the what we call chisantamo, that occurs during the process of dying. And fourth, if we make the difference based on the gross or subtlety of its object, the object of the consciousness, then we will say the consciousness that connects a subtle object is more subtler than the consciousness that apprehends grosser object. And from tantrical point of view, I think these two are differentiated based on the subtlety or grossness of the wind energy that is the basis of mental consciousness. As I said, I'm going to talk about only main points of these sections, so I'm going to jump to the next section. And now I'm going to talk about a little bit what is mind and the mental factor or mental event. The difference between mind and mental factor, to explain this, here I have a quote by Maitreya, and which says that which sees the object is the mind, that which deals with it aspects are mental factor. So mental factors are either the aspect of the mind or the specifics of its function. So if I try to put in a simple word to make it easier to understand, the one example would be, if we look at something, while our eye consciousness captures the entity aspect, the object, there are several mental factors that are engaging, they are simultaneously engaging with it. And there's engagement of feeling, there's engagement of discernment, there's engagement of intention, attention, and contact. And these are we called five omnipresent mental factors. There are many mental factors, but I'm not going to list each of those. I think Geshe-la Lobsang is going to talk about this in the coming presentations. What is the function of these mental factors or mental events? This mental factor or mental events just does not capture the entity aspects of the object, but it does more than it, or more than that. For example, each of the mental factor has a specific function, such as bringing feeling aspect of it and making a judgment of whether it judgment of the color of the object. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about the purpose. Why Buddhists have spent so much time studying mind, consciousness, and all categories of the, you know, different types of consciousness. And to talk about that, I thought it might be better to share three traditional approaches to the questions, to deal with the question of mind, from Abhidhamma texts, from epistemological texts, scriptures, from Vajraya or Trantri texts. Abhidhamma texts, scripture, focuses on causal process of 100 mental states and emotional states, and subjective experience of these states and their effect on our thought and behavior, and which could be called psychology therapy or something. And epistemological text analyzes the nature and characteristics of perception, knowledge, and their relation with language and thought in order to develop visual frame to understand the different aspects of consciousness. And from the tantric textbooks deal with conceptual thought experience in the context of deep meditational setting, and beside that there's numerous yogi postures, enhancing well-being in general, and affecting elimination of afflictive emotions. And specifically talk about the purpose of carrying out analysis of mind in Buddhism. The main objective of Buddhism psychology is not to gather data on the source, make up etc. of the mind, nor to build explanation on the way mind functions. Rather, it is directed toward the quest to eliminate suffering in general and in particle. So I think the essence of Buddhism is profoundly comprises in this stanza, which says by Buddha himself, which says, "Do not commit any non-virtues. Commit virtues to the utmost, tame one's mind to the fullest. This is the teaching of Buddha." So I hope I have roughly presented some of the main points of my sections, and this is pretty much what I have got to present, and thank you all. Thank you, Your Holiness. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tsongpo. And now that we've heard from our first two presenters, we're going to hear from our discussant, Brian Dias.
Namaste, Tashi Dele, Your Holiness. An important component of what we've been talking about this morning has been experience. And the consciousness of person A versus the consciousness of person B is probably going to be different because of the experiences that they've had. What I would like to talk to you about this morning is how we think that experience is registered by biological systems, and then how that might filter into how we perceive the world. For that, I have to introduce a concept called epigenetics. So you spoke on the first day about chromosomes and DNA on chromosomes. The DNA on chromosomes have chemical marks that let them either be read or not read. that idea of that code, the genetic code, being expressed or not, is called epigenetics. Whether something gets expressed is dependent on certain factors which are in the cell at a particular time, or certain marks which are present on the DNA. And if it's not expressed, there are a different set of marks. Now, why is that important? It's important for two reasons. One is, within a generation, as Dr. Koch talked about, there's a language in the brain which is the electrical language. Just like the electrical language, there's a molecular language where environmental experiences can add marks to the DNA, or they can remove marks from the DNA, and that will allow for some genes to be expressed and others not to be expressed. So you can imagine a situation now where you have an impoverished condition or a negative condition which lays down certain marks, versus not, and that might give you a neuron developing in one way versus another, or circuits in one way versus another. So that is how we think about epigenetics within a generation. What I also want to talk about is something that I study in my laboratory and is a growing field of research, although controversial, which is called transgenerational epigenetics. And the basis and motivation for this field is historical events which have suggested that ancestral traumas have left imprints on the descendant generations. So we know that descendants of Holocaust survivors, some descendants, have lower cortisol levels, which predispose them to post-traumatic stress disorder later in life. We know, for example, in the Dutch hunger winter in 1944, when there was no food going into the Netherlands because of the World War II, that there were famine-like conditions, and that resulted in birth defects and other mental health abnormalities in generations that were not even conceived at the time. So what we now appreciate is how this is occurring. So what we now understand is that these traumas are laying down marks, or they're removing marks in the sperm or in the egg, and that sets up the future generations to bear these imprints of ancestral trauma. And so when I hear Sang Pola talking about eliminating suffering, the goal for us studying this field is to be able to intervene in some way, either in the ancestral generation or in the descendant generation, to reverse these marks that have been laid down. And so to summarize, epigenetics and transgenerational epigenetics are one language used by the nervous system and biology in general, which then allow for an individual's conscious experience in some way to be sculpted, like, for example, the manifestation of PTSD or anxiety in their own lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Brian. And next we'll hear from our second discussant, Gelek Jatsov. Please.
Good morning, Your Holiness. I have never in my dream thought that I would be talking about Buddhist concept in front of you. This is such a great honor for me. I'm very grateful for Your Holiness and for ETSI as for this wonderful opportunity. I just wanted to make 3 points. The first is about multiplicity of the consciousness that arise simultaneously. Buddha says that as long as we are alive, we will have an unbroken continuous stream of mental consciousness. So when we are awake and looking at things, we will have 2 consciousness, one mental consciousness and 1 eye consciousness. Right now, I think almost all of us have at least 3 consciousness, one mental, 1 eye, 1 ear consciousness. Also, we can have at most 6 consciousness At the same time, the stream of mental consciousness never ceases, and at the time of the death, it is this consciousness that leaves the body and takes new rebirth. The claim that mental consciousness always abides may lead to a nice scientific experiment, provided the scientists could find neurocorrelates for mental consciousness. In that case, the Buddhist claim would lead to the prediction that the neurocorrelates of mental consciousness would always be active and strong and sending signals. My second point is, what's happening to sensory consciousness? What's happening to sensory consciousness when there's no longer an input? The Buddha says that the sensory consciousness ceases to be when there's no input. The consciousness turns into what we call bacha, which is translated as mental imprint or potentiality. The five sensory consciousness arise and dissolved, and again, in a repeated process of the birth and termination, influenced by the input from external or internal world. Now the questions may arise, where's that potentiality? We say on the mental stream, one school of Buddhist thought have a wonderful description to convey this idea. They call this consciousness the stone house consciousness. And my third point is about types of consciousnesses that have modes of apprehension that are directly contradictory to each other. For example, ignorance and wisdom are said to have modes of apprehension that are directly contradictory with respect to a common object. Ignorance and apprehending the table to have independence existence, and the wisdom apprehended the table to have not dependent existence are said to be in this relationship. Because of this relationship, when one grows stronger, the other automatically weakens. This is true for all pairs of consciousness that are in this kind of relationship. The reason why I raise this point is that if neurocorrelates are found for two minds that are this kind of relationship, growth of one would implant the weakness of the other, an event that theoretically would be observed using imaging these techniques. So this is another experiment that neuroscience could perform once the correlates are found. Thanks, Your Holiness.
Thank you. So a rich set of presentations where we're also seeing some real differences in terms of the notion of what consciousness is. Is there one? Is it unitary? It's here, not here? Or is it multiple in form? And it touches on many things we've been talking about over the last 2 days, and a number of people here will have things to say. But before we get started on a general discussion, Your Holiness, Would you care to say anything right now? Nothing right now? Okay. Well,
as he mentioned, when the Yuji Lamine, right? Yuji Lamine,
minus focus on one object, you can have a wrong perception. After that, then it can lead to doubt. And after that, it can lead to inference. And that kind of thought process, can we have a description from the neuroscience point of view?
As Gelegla presented towards the end of his speech, when he talked about there being two types of consciousness, or which have the same object, the focal object, but apprehending the same object differently, and he gave the example of ignorance and wisdom. And so in this regard, His Holiness would like to ask, and could there be that kind of a distorted consciousness, distorted cognition, like ignorance, which later kind of changes, transitions into some kind of a state of a doubt that you would have, and then because of the doubt, is there a way to transit that into inferential consciousness, changing that into inferential consciousness? Could you actually find, regarding these, could you actually find some very neural correlates of these?
The challenge would be in a lab. How do I do this when I have a volunteer, a student who comes in to serve as a subject? I have to be able to induce a state of doubt, and then 5 minutes later, a state of wisdom, and then again a state of doubt, and a state of wisdom, and do this 50 times in order to average, in order to get the brain activity. So I don't know how to induce a state of doubt and a state of wisdom in a subject. And I don't know, and scientists don't know how to do that in a mouse. Our most favorite model for all of this is a mouse, believe it or not, they're little. So it's very difficult. I don't know. We don't know how to study these advanced states in animals and in people. So we use fear.
Yeah, that's right.
Fear,
that's right.
And we use vision. Mm. You know, vision, imagination, yeah. Seeing.
Sensorial level consciousness. Animal, we human being, more or less same. So same.
Yes.
Now mental level, there's big differences. So I think in order to as a deeper investigation about humans or the consciousness, mental consciousness. I think you need some sacrifice, some human being.
Oh dear!
Well,
it is impossible, is it, to know animal brain? Impossible. So only on a human being.
Yes, that is the challenge, how to do that. In a lab. How do we do that in a laboratory? It's very difficult.
Of course. Of course.
It's the limit of what we can do.
So it is, I think, quite obvious. The consciousness is so sort of sophisticated. And that fully sort of explain the full explanation about that on the level, on the basis of because of biology or say matters or genes or these things, particles. So I think essentially we have to sort of accept two things, physical thing and just a mere experience. That's what we call consciousness. So in any way, further investigation and experiment I think really very helpful. So?
Taking up for the mice, we can...
No, actually, since many years, I sort of suggested some, not only Buddhist, but some Indian non-Buddhist sort of practitioner, who have certain sort of experience. So these, some of our such meeting, I think should make available, then some discussion according to their own experience. And in the past, some Tibetan who spent many years in the mountain, so they have certain sort of unusual experience. So I think one of them actually went to America and carried some sort of in the laboratory, some sort of today.
Brain scanning?
That's mainly inner heat.
A tumor?
Tumu. Yeah. Yes, tumu. And actually, you see, there are people who can remain in snow. It's 24 hours without any dress. But their inner heat, so because of the powerful, the surrounding their sort of area, the snow melt. That experience is happening. So this worthwhile to further investigation, like Mahakumbh Mela, the number of sort of sadhus, complete negative. Some of them, live in mountain area whole year. So I think these are really worthwhile now. Kasurda, let them sort of explain what is their experience. And some experiment in on their bodies. It's no harmful.
No.
And I think after experiment, give some money, I think some may appreciate. Yes.
So some people have studied free divers. So these people go to great depths in the ocean with no oxygen mask or no oxygen gear whatsoever, and can hold their breath for minutes, several minutes and hours at times, at really low depths. And so people are studying that. But what it seems like, it's more the physiological system that has adapted to training that they have undergone over extended periods of time. Like the sadhus, being up at high altitude has probably changed their physiological systems that now allows them to function in a completely different physiological space than people who don't have that training, so to speak.
Lobsang?
The topic of consciousness is a topic that is probably the most relevant topic for discussion between the neuroscientist and the monastic science scholars. But when we talk about consciousness, I think we have to understand that two traditions come from a very specific, fundamental paradigm, different paradigms. Daniel Goleman, in his book called Emotional Intelligence, he makes this case that the Actually, not the emotional intelligence. It's one of the, I think, destructive emotions. He mentions that the modern science, when it comes to understanding consciousness, the fundamental paradigm is that consciousness ultimately is reducible to arises. It ultimately has to do with physical property of the physical phenomenon, whether it's brain, you can go to minute levels, genes and so forth, but without a physical basis, you can't see consciousness. And this is something His Holiness has mentioned yesterday also. At what level, excuse me, you know, at what level the mind or the consciousness emerges from the physical properties, at what level of complexity of the physical properties enable the emergence or the giving rise of the consciousness. So it seems like that the dominant neuroscience to this point assumes that mind or the consciousness is what the brain does. And whereas the Buddhist tradition, the Buddhist contemplative traditions, as Venerable Sampo presented here, the fundamental paradigm of the consciousness or the mind is not reducible to our it doesn't need to be dependent on some physical kind of, at least coarse physical properties. And that's what allows Buddhists to maintain the various degrees of subtlety of consciousness. Consciousness can be coarser when it depends on coarse level of hormonal and biochemical processes, and the certain sensory faculties and so forth. But it can also be subtler, dependent on the subtler levels of what Buddhists call the energy. But ultimately, the continuum of consciousness is something that can go from coarser to subtler and very subtle, and then in reverse into coarse and subtle. But from the tantric Buddhist perspective, the energy and the mind, the consciousness, are interdependent, related. In fact, ultimately, at the very subtle level, these two can be seen as expression of the single entity, the Lungtsum Ngo Chikwa, Chukwa Chikwa, that this energy-mind complex that can be seen as two expressions of a singular continuum. And this is where I think that, Christoph, you know, when you mentioned earlier with regard to the consciousness, could there be a separate stream or the physical, basis, you know, that may give rise to a mental experience or the conscious experience, not simply, you know, dependent on the brain and so forth. So I think that the ultimately the from the Buddhist tradition, at least the way that I see it, is that tantric or the highest yoga tantra tradition, when it presents the mind as interdependent and ultimately as the same nature or the same entity expressed in two ways, as one as the energy that can become physical, transform into the course of physical properties, and then related to that also the mental and emotional states also can become coarser as the consciousness become, as energy become coarser. So coarser levels of energies as they dissolve, then the coarser levels of mental activities dissolve, and that can correspond to like the sleep, the dream and sleep, or ultimately from the alive state to the states of what is referred to as the clear light of death and so forth.
I have one question. One question. Memory and sharpness of mind. Can you predict after sort of investigation about brain? Can you say, oh, this person with such brain memory is very good. This person, because of certain sort of the element in the brain or sharpness of mind is there. Can you say that?
We can begin to read out in animals their memories. We can imprint memories directly into the brain of mice, and we can now begin to read out the memory of mice, and we can begin to predict which specific nerve cells in which specific part of the brain called the hippocampus is involved in memory. Yes.
No, this is not very harmful. So the human being, the certain sort of wires and so on. Even I think take some sort of drops from their brain and analyze. I think not harmful.
No, but the problem with studying humans is from the point of view of a scientist is look but don't touch. I cannot go inside a human brain unless I do surgery, because that wouldn't be ethical. Hmm. So for humans, I can study from the outside using brain waves or magnetic scanner, but I can't go inside and poke them and add this gene or add that neurotransmitter. That I can do in mice or in other animals. I wanted to very briefly to reply. So the basic dogma in neuroscience is four words. No brain, never mind. No brain, never mind. It's like a koan. It's like a Japanese koan. Now you can generalize it because we don't really know what the fundamental nature of matter is, that we all believe, and certainly the vast majority of philosophers and people who study consciousness believe there has to be some sort of physical mechanism. Without some sort of physical mechanism, be it super string or whatever fancy physics there will be, there has to be a physical mechanism to support mental. There cannot be mental without some sort of physical mechanism.
So, Michelle,
so that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, often when we have these kind of conversations and the scientists say that no brain, never mind, or the consciousness reduced to some level of physical kind of basis, the correlates. And those physical correlates tend to be something that you can physiologically measure, whether it's the brain or you can take it down to genetic levels. But what I'm saying is that from the Buddhist point of view, the lung or the energy as you said, where the super string is a form of energy, right? So likewise, the Buddhist postulation of energy, the lung, is an energy, and therefore that when if you think that the mind correlates with the energy levels at the very it can go to a subtlest level of energy, and if there are certain kinds of energy that has a certain property of consciousness, why can't that be, you know, like that's what so therefore that could there be a could as a neuroscientist you can foresee a discovery of kind of energy that may have the characteristic of that subjective, the consciousness as its property.
As long as this energy can act in my brain, because I don't know any evidence that there's consciousness without my brain.
So when you do experiments in laboratory on consciousness, how much of the first person account is taken into consideration? Is there any experimental or system of, is there any way that has been developed to establish a reliable way of taking the first person account into consideration?
So there is this tradition of called phenomenologists. It's a small tradition only in psychology and in neuroscience that try to capture the vast, you know, when I just look at this, it's vast, it's filled with vast amount of information, all the colors, all the spatial relationship, left, right, up, down. So people are only now realizing that this vast amount of information, because usually people say, well, you can only remember 7 bits, so your mind is very low baud rate. But in fact, there's vast amount of information, and even in a black scene, because there's still spatial relationships. And so people are now only now beginning to develop those sort of first person's account to try to capture quantitatively all the data, the information that's inside a single conscious experience.
This is a perfect segue, I think, because Michel, you've been wanting to chime in.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a question for Chris. I very much appreciated, in fact, your
Chris talk. Or Christoph? I'm Christoph. He's Chris.
Yes, sorry. I was abbreviating. So your conference was really wonderful, and I especially appreciated that you started from the obvious presence of experience. But on the other hand, I have a problem of vocabulary with what you said. When you are very prudent, you speak of neural correlates of consciousness. You speak also that you say that consciousness is associated with a particular brain working, but when you are less prudent, you say that the brain generates consciousness, that you are looking for neural mechanisms that give rise to consciousness or for the source of consciousness in the brain. When you use the second set of words, you strongly suggest...
Okay. Yes, continue.
When you use the second set of words, such as source of consciousness, you strongly suggest that the brain is more fundamental than consciousness, that it is the cause of consciousness. But I think that none of the wonderful experiments you quoted, and even those you didn't quote, can support this dissymmetry between the two. Because, in fact, for instance, according to the same experiments, the brain could just be an amplifier, a modulator of conscious experience, rather than a producer of experience. I think that you, with your panpsychism, you come very close to this idea. But then I would suggest you something to make your view more balanced. You say that consciousness is how a complex material system, such as the brain, feels from the inside. Can't you say, conversely, that the brain is how consciousness appears when seen from the outside? In that case, I think you would be quite compatible with the Buddhist view that was exposed, according to which that which is not consciousness cannot be the origin of consciousness.
So I do believe that the brain as a physical system viewed from inside, that's what conscious experience is.
And can't you say that consciousness as seen from outside, it looks like the brain?
That's a physical system, yes.
Yes. It's a physical system seen by a consciousness.
Yes. But now the next question is, what is it about this particular physical system that gives a consciousness? And can that system, or can that phone in your pocket, can that also have this dual aspect, this inside and the outside aspect?
That's right. Yes, that is I think the way you posited the question now is good. How is it that this kind of system is associated with consciousness?
But then it's still a question of causal supervenience. You still need the physical matter. Without the physical matter, you wouldn't get the mental, the consciousness. You need both.
Yes, but well, here again. Well.
So let's let physicists weigh in here, and then we'll hear from Chopin.
Yes. So a comment and a question for Christoph. The comment is almost trivial, and I'm not being facetious, but when you talked about the difficulty of getting having emotional states in humans, you know, with large data rates and being able to gather data, I suggest actors. Okay. So method actors are trained essentially to use imagination and memory to generate essentially a physiological manifestation of disgust, fear, strong emotions, and a range of them. And you don't need to be, you know, Academy Award level. So there are a lot of good, hungry actors, don't need a very high rate. And they could, you could get a pretty large amount of data and repetition, because they have to do repetitions. They have to do 30 takes where they have to remember someone who died and cry and it's and so on in a mode. Okay, that's just a trivial suggestion for gathering data.
It's a clever one.
Yeah.
It's a clever one.
And the question is about something you mentioned in passing. I just want to come back to in a different way. When you alluded to some of the computational and machine variations on this theme, your examples were self-driving cars and personal assistants on smartphones. But I wanted to ask about this other sort of bottom-up agenda that has existed for decades, of course, of modeling, you know, brain activity with neural nets or consciousness, not even approaching consciousness, but it's really, so it's a twofold question of, first, for people who don't know, what is the status of those sort of bottom-up approaches, computational-based approaches? Are they proving fruitful at all? And second, you know, the sort of more algorithmic approaches, which I would call AI or something like that, what is their status in your view as far as illuminating the subject you study?
So there's, you probably heard there's a very large project in Europe under Henry Markram called the Human Brain Project. And their attempt is to model, it's based in Switzerland, they want to model the human brain in all of its detail. And the belief of smart money in Silicon Valley says that if you can do this in 100 years, if you have a perfect computer simulation of the human brain, including every neuron, you hit the button, the computer will wake up and say, "Hi, I'm the blue brain." And I say, "How do you do?" I say, "I feel fine." And everybody will say, "Well, of course, you get conscious experience because you've simulated all the underlying functional relationship." I personally think no. Consciousness is ultimately has to do with causal powers, and you can never simulate consciousness. But people in Silicon Valley don't like that. And so the dominant metaphor today in the West is of computationalism, that just like you can simulate gravity of a black hole in your simulation, you can simulate and you can simulate consciousness. Practically speaking, they're very, very far away from that, just practically speaking, and we'll get good models of human behavior using AI much sooner than we'll get them using bottom-up simulation for interesting reasons we can talk about.
So I guess the sort of second-tier question is, absent that grandiose agenda that I agree is overreaching, Do these computational approaches work as far as being illustrative models of how the, you know, neurochemistry works or how the electrochemical network of the brain works? Are they helpful in that sense?
Yes, they're locally helpful. There's no grand unified theory. I don't think there ever will be of the brain, but they're local models that explain this phenomena or things how work in the retina or how they work in the inner ear or how they work on memory. Yes. But they don't illuminate the question of consciousness at all.
Wait, I think Awang and then Geshe-la.
I just want to make a remark about the presentation of Dr. Koh. It's really encouraging that, you know, the progression that neuroscience had made so far on searching for consciousness. Although the approach, more towards that approach that you applied, a reductionist kind of approach, where you are trying to find consciousness on a physical basis. I think as a Buddhist, I believe that there is no way that you can find consciousness on this, applying this method. But while observing the conversation that's being taken place here, I find that we are also neglecting, I may be wrong, but the beautiful presentation that Sangolas gave about the mind and mental factors, mm-hmm. and he present about the five omnipresence always there with the consciousness. But when we try to define, or when all the scholars that I observe so far, they try to neglect the other factors that are involved. So in a way, we are also in some sort of a direction that science has applied, reductionist kind of a, so which is, I think, a little bit incomplete. So if we need to get to the consciousness, then we have to include the five omnipresent that's there, so that I think it will become give us a fuller picture. And then there is a, I think that could be one way that we can be able to comprehend what consciousness itself is, not searching for the basis of it.
Yeah, I think we'd like you to elaborate on that. That's a really interesting point. So, Brian?
So I'd like to first address what Geshe Lobsang said and then what Geshe Nawang said. So I think we're talking in some way about similar things. I mean, I don't think we should ignore the fact that when we eavesdrop on cells firing in the brain, that's we're eavesdropping on electrical energy, right? So it is an energy that we're talking about. And I think contemporary neuroscience, with all the tools that we have, has definitively proved that that is the neural correlate of consciousness as we define it. And so, yes, there are other energies in the brain. You have cerebrospinal fluid coursing through the ventricles, and that forms a source of maybe kinetic energy. But to be able to definitively prove that that is another source that gives you a conscious percept, I think will take a lot of effort. But so I think we are there is a common language here in terms of energy. It's just at the level that we're talking about. And then Geshe Nawang, I think if I understand correctly, the mental factors are things like joy or feelings. And
to explain that, mental factors, when I talk about the first five omnipresent mental factors, it includes feeling, discernment, intention, attention, and contact. So feeling is the bringing the feeling aspects of the object that is being perceived by the consciousness itself. And contact is kind of the kind of letting consciousness engage with the object.
Yeah, so I do think that when we do our experiments to identify these neural correlates, we are also trying to get a sense for how these feelings, how these emotions actually modulate what your conscious percept is. So it's not like we're ignoring them. We're trying to get to a minimal unit of consciousness and then talk about how that can be layered upon with these mental factors. So I don't think we're ignoring them per se.
Yes, we Buddhists actually believe, as Ngawala said, whenever there is a rise of any type of mental consciousness, and there are all these five omnipresents, mental factors, mental events. So when you try to find or investigate the location of consciousness somewhere in the brain region, and when the consciousness arises, when it activates somewhere in the brain region, maybe it is a new field for scientists to investigate whether there is any other kind of factors that are emerging with the consciousness region of the brain.
So there are some beautiful experiments now that people do, particularly also in my lab, where they try to show that you can get attention without consciousness, and that you can have attention, that you can have consciousness without attention, so that you can dissociate things between attention and consciousness. Because it used to be thought that attention and consciousness go hand in hand together. But you can now at least experimentally show that you can attend to things, but you're not conscious of them. So this is what scientists love. They like to take these things and then try to dissociate them and then try to study that.
Mm. Well, then perhaps this is great. Maybe we can hear from Geshe Lakdor on this point.
I have an observation and also a question. My observation is, in this kind of dialogue, I think it is extremely important to make certain points very clear. the fact that we are not able to converse quite well with regard to consciousness is there is no not clear definition of what consciousness is that is being used in science and probably in Buddhism also.
Yes. So this
now, for example, it occurs to me that the word consciousness that is used in science is something that is borrowed from the Western philosophy, and of course it is natural because Western science is more or less a product of Western philosophy. In the case of the Buddhist concept of mind or consciousness, it has two important components. The mind being luminous and also cognitive. Luminous means just like any object coming within the purview of a mirror, it has the capacity to reflect the object coming within its purview. But mind is more than that mirror. It does not only allow the object come within the purview of the mirror, but it also has the capacity to perceive it, the cognitive part. So therefore, my simple question is, on the one hand, science as of now is unable to explain a mind or consciousness that is not related to physical or brain. But at the same time, it talks about the conception, perception, cognitivity, and so forth. So all these experiences, the cognitive and perception experiences, to me, is primarily a first-person experience. So my question is, how do you measure the experiential part?
Geshe-ngawa something.
Hello. In continuation to what Geshe-ngawa has said. Yeah. So the consciousness, when Christoph, you said that there is attention, but without consciousness. So how can there be, from Buddhist perspective, attention itself is consciousness. So again, because of the ambiguity of the term and the concept of the meaning of the consciousness, there's some problem that we as the attention is a cognitive entity, and the itself is consciousness. So when you say that there is attention but no consciousness, so how would you define the consciousness but the having attention without consciousness?
Okay, so about definition. So I think science, it's less about rigorous definition. Definition usually happen when you write a textbook. Then you try to define things like a planet is. And then often you get into difficulty. So instead, science works by having a working hypothesis, by having an operation, and you apply this operation, and you use this operational definition. So we have sort of working definitions of conscious experience and attention, how to manipulate it. So I can get you to fix it here, and then I show something here or here, and I ask you, can you detect it? And so this is an operational definition of, can you dissociate, can you shift your attention around? And so we have these practical ways. Now, they may not be exactly what you mean by, you have a 2,400-year-old tradition of it, sophisticated, and it may not exactly map onto what we mean in the lab when we practically measure attention or manipulate attention in the laboratory.
This is precisely the the place where the two traditions not having a clearer sense of what is meant by consciousness when the neuroscientists like yourself say consciousness. For Buddhists, when the term consciousness is used as a broad term that includes all mental states, whether it's emotional states, perceptions, sensory perceptions, as well as mental states, memory, all of these are included. So that's why it comes across little bit strange when you hear that you can have intention without consciousness, because intention
attention
you know, which in Tibetan is yila jeba, you know, that's one of the five, these omnipresent mental factors. For a Buddhist scholar or a student of mine, it simply makes no sense to say there is attention without consciousness, because attention is part of consciousness. It is one of the, you know, mental factors. So therefore, it's very important for in this kind of discussions to make clear that when you say consciousness, it has to do with this, you know, as you mentioned that, you know, that it has to do with this qualia issue, right? You know, that when you see like the green, knowing, you know, the seeing the green. So, because from the Buddhist point of view, even the sleep is part of consciousness. You know, sleep is one of the mental factors that is called the changeable mental factors. But obviously, the Buddhists wouldn't say that in sleep, unless you are a very advanced meditator, that, you know, you will be aware of what you are experiencing, what you are knowing, what you are engaged with. So in the scientific field, when they say consciousness, it has to do with, in some cases, reportable experiences, right? You know, like this. So if somebody asks that, what did you see? If you were conscious of what you saw, then you can say that, oh, I saw a bird or the, you know, green. But when you are asked, when a cross is flashed on the screen or face is flashed on the screen, that earlier you showed that, if it's flashed so quickly, if you are not able to report back what you saw at the face, then you would say that, you know, even though face, the image of the face was there, flashed, but you were not conscious of seeing the face, right?
But people have very subtle techniques now. Right, so people,
so people
study those phenomena called subliminal perception, or when you see it, but it's so quick you can't report upon it, and you can still see a signature in the brain.
No, I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying is just simply for the conversation to not go, you know, kind of across without meeting. When a face is flashed so quickly on the screen, neuroscientists, when they said that they were not conscious of the face, it simply means that you did not have consciousness because you cannot report. You know, no. You did not have enough.
No, it also means if I can do the experiment on myself. I flash it and I immediately afterwards show another image. Then I simply don't see the first image. I simply do not see it.
That's fine, but you are saying that attention is there.
But it's the duration, or particularly if I show immediately a second image, the second image will wipe out the impression left in the brain from the first image and does not give enough time for my brain to generate the neural conditions for conscious experience to occur.
That's fine. I mean,
there is no conscious experience in this case.
There's no conscious experience. That's what you are saying.
Yes.
You know, that cognitive neuroscientists will say that. You know, there is no conscious experience. But for the Buddhist to say that there was attention, you know, that your attention engaged with that face, but were not conscious of that. That's possible, you know, that. But it's simply the language needs to be different, you know, that you are not aware of seeing. There are words like in Buddhism, like there is and nang lamang, you know, that there is a certain perception that's called the perceived but not ascertained. When you are so deeply engaged with certain sound, you could have visual images in front of you, but they are there. Stimulus impinge on your retina and so forth. You simply are not aware of that. That can be possible.
So here I think we're really beginning to see how these engagements really call forth the necessity to clarify the constructs that we're using, and this is exactly what scientists and Buddhists are really interested in. And so, and we may be needing to build a new lexicon of science in science, not just a new lexicon of science in Buddhism. So for that, I think, Sindhu, you had a comment you wanted to make?
I have one little thing to add.
Wait, sorry. Sindhu is waiting to talk. Thank you.
My comment is not really about the lexicon, but I have a question and a suggestion. My question is, we know that, or neuroscientists know that brain is important for all these conscious experience. But then neuroscientists are not satisfied. They want to go deeper and find parts within the brain that are responsible for these experience. So how far should you go before you say that, okay, now we found the neurocorrelate? Do we go down until a single neuron, or do you have to go even further down to molecules or even atoms? So how far down you need to go before you say that, oh, this is the, these are the neural correlates of the conscious experience? That's my question. And my suggestion earlier, His Holiness raised this point about two different types of consciousness that have same focal object, say this cup or this glass, and then having two entirely different mode of apprehension. So one consciousness apprehends this cup as impermanent, and the other consciousness, you know, apprehends this object or this glass as permanent. So you have the same object, but two ways of, you know, comprehending. And these two modes are said to be, in Buddhist literature, these are considered as directly contradictory modes of apprehension. And the significance of that in Buddhist literature is that these two types of consciousness or these two types of mind are said to be in directly contradictory. So therefore, when one strengthens, the other automatically weakens, right? So is it possible to find a neurocorrelate, you know, that would respond in this manner? Because, you know, this is such an important concept in Buddhism, not only from the understanding of mind, but also it has a very practical implication. The fact that ignorance could be reduced and totally removed is based on this concept, that a mind, when it's focused on the object and have a have its mode of apprehension that is completely contradictory to the ignorance, then you'll be able to strengthen that, and in return, your ignorance is reduced and finally, you know, removed.
Yeah, so that's a very good suggestion. People have done experiments, so-called bistable perception, with a cube, for instance. A cube, you either see like this or like this. And so, and you can easily only see it like this or like this. Now, nobody has ever done the experiments that His Holiness has suggested, but in principle, you can get meditators, long-term meditators, and you can get them to do exactly that, to look at the object in one way, when it's permanent, and in a different way, and then observe which different parts of the brain are involved. The question, so that can definitely be done. That's an experiment that can be done. It's not even that difficult. The question is then what you do with that. So now, you know, whenever I see this is impermanent, this part of the brain is active. And when I see it as permanent, this part of the brain is active. Well, so that tells us something about where these cognitive operations are performed. Okay, so permanence is here and impermanence is there. So that's the sort of knowledge you can get from a neuroscience experiment. The question is, how useful is that going to be to you? Because now I guess you can go around and zap this part of the brain to try to get people to see things permanently, and you can remove that part of the brain so people...
I have a few things to...
Actually, we have Geshe Palden Drakpa, who has a little comment that he'd like to make.
In front of his Holiness, when we had the first conference with scientists, at that time there was a young scientist, he told us that you should not have a personal philosophical disposition. You have to eliminate that. Now, when I and he said that it seems that he said that science.
Can
you translate,
Cindy? Geshe Palden Thakpala attended another conference like this, perhaps the previous Mind and Life conference here. And at that time, Geshe-la says that there was a young scientist who actually said that scientists do not have their own position as such, that they don't hold on to some strict position as scientists. But listening to the presentations here, it seemed like scientists have their own position. So how is that?
It is what Michelle and John said, right? We are scientists, but we're also people. And of course we have our own subjective bias, right? We come from somewhere, we have particular beliefs, and it's very difficult for us to dissociate ourselves fully from that. It's a challenge.
I think as far as sort of consciousness or mind is concerned, I think, as you mentioned, among the scientists, in the past, not much pay attention. Now, end of 20th century, begin to pay more attention. So something like, this is something, because of the subject which study or investigate something new. So, so sometimes, maybe, I think too bold, I express the Western psychology, compare ancient Indian psychology, that means including, actually, you see, the Indian psychology. All those, you see, the great masters of Nalanda, you see, they are Indian. You see, all their sort of knowledge, you see, they come from that.
We actually gathered them
from different existing Indian tradition. Then they themselves also, you see, further investigate, and also I think including their own inner experience. So highly developed. So therefore, sometimes I express the modern scientist, modern psychology, it looks like kindergarten level. So, you see, that does not mean we remain that level, further develop, with, I think, open mind. That's, I think, really, I found genuine scientist really unbiased sort of attitude, as open. Sometimes we Buddhist, a little bit biased. So it is really wonderful, wonderful. Then, now I think okay, like that.
Okay, thank you, Your Holiness. I think Lobsang had a comment, and then
yes. When we talk about...
Sorry, Lobsang, excuse me, I made a mistake. Geshe-la.
Tanda nga kong da shuya ye. Karere kong da chong nga to
Regarding the presentation of Geshe-la, Geshe Panden Thakpala wants to make a comment here regarding the function of the consciousness, so to say. I mean, the different kibar.
Mind and mental factor.
Regarding the mind and mental factors, the mind is said to be that which cognizes or perceives the object as a whole, its nature, and then the mental factors are said to engage with the object in specific ways in with regard to the properties or properties. Regard to different properties or something like that. And then Geshe-la would like to make this comment that with regard to the property, the term property here, or the difference, there is the difference in terms of experience and then difference in terms of kind of a movement or motion of the consciousness, and then in terms of the validity of the consciousness.
Do you have a comment or sample?
I actually haven't heard it properly, but what I'm assuming what Geshe-la said, I'm assuming what he has said. It seems what he's saying, what Geshe-la is saying, is that when we differentiate between mind and mental event, and I basically differentiated based on based on aspects and its function, its specific function, mind and mental. When I talk about the mind and its mental factor, I differentiated based on mental consciousness is something that perceives the entity aspects of the object that is being perceived by the mental consciousness, and the mental event is not just perceiving the object of the mental consciousness, but rather it does more specific function of the mental consciousness. And what it does is that it brings feeling aspects of it. And also, for instance, the mental event of feeling, it brings a feeling aspect of it. And for the contact, it does the function of letting mental consciousness engage to the objects of the mental consciousness, but there is a two different ways of making a differentiation these two, the mental consciousness and the mental factor. The one way we can make is different based on the object. The mental event is something that mostly paying attention to comprehend the attributes of the object, not just the entity, attributes of the object. And mental consciousness is, of course, as I said, because it is mental consciousness, the reason is it is just mainly responsible to detect the all entity of the object. So what Geshe-la was saying is why there is a two definition. If I'm correct, what he said is what that is he said. So I think it is a different ways of interpretation. But indeed, what the mind and the mental factor is need to be differentiated based on mind, mental aspects, and its function. But they do have a same aspect. So they do have a same aspect of identifying or comprehending the object, and they do have a they do have a similar quality, or they, some, I don't know, the quality of the mental quality of their mind, and they engage simultaneously to the object, and Mi'kmaq-tsongba is also the object of this mental consciousness, and mental events are the same. So that is pretty much what I have to say, but what I am confident is that if Geshe Panden La does not know about these things, then I'm pretty sure I cannot explain that.
I think what I heard the question about validity, was that correct? There was the issue of valid perception. Was that part of the question that Geshe La raised? Because that hasn't come up yet, right? As I understand it, one of the issues in ignorance is that perception is not always valid, right? We may have a perception, but it's obscured. It's not a real reflection. So how does that come into the picture?
You mean the ignorance is not valid?
Yeah, well, he raised the question of validity. How do you, what makes a valid perception? Is that right?
Oh, you mean the what makes the perception valid?
Yeah.
What makes the perception valid? I think it depends on the way how it apprehends the object. And if, for example, if you're apprehending this cup as a permanent entity or permanent object, and then this kind of perception is not valid and invalid. It is very obvious. And for the ignorance, in our innate thought, we have some sort of tendency to automatically thinking something like we do exist on our intrinsic nature, and without dependent on any other kind of physical aggregates. So that kind of perceiving is a completely wrong view. So this is that's why it is invalid. So we so because of this kind of wrong view or self-grasping, and we believe it brings more attachment toward yourself, and also it arises making a discrimination between your relatives and other people, and between and your country and other country, and it creates the boundary, and that's why we think we Buddhists think this is the root cause of all the problem that we create in this world. So in order to if someone really want to destroy or get rid of the suffering, then it is better to challenge with the source or roots of that suffering, which is the ignorance.
That's very helpful. Thank you. I think actually that Lobsang has been very patient.
Sorry.
And you have a comment, and then Sindhu, I think, did you
want to have something? I think when scientists talk about consciousness, it talks about, if I understood correctly, it talks about awareness, almost like being aware of something or to apprehend the object or to know the object. And but sometimes you can have an experience of something, but you're not able to apprehend it. You're not able to say, I saw this and that. For example, if you're seeing a dance performance with a equal degree of attention to the visual information and auditory information, you experience both information at the same time, simultaneously. You have this experience of visual information and auditory information, but at the same time, depending on the degree of attention, you're able to apprehend the visual information but not the auditory information. and vice versa. So I was wondering if how do you distinguish the perception of the consciousness, conscious experience, and apprehension, or how do you distinguish these two? Like cognizing something, knowing something, and consciousness, conscious experience.
So the most popular way in science to view any perception is as an inference. I have my brain, my brain has to infer based on the responses what's out there. And sometimes it's pretty good, it's valid, like I really believe there's a glass outside there. And sometimes it can be false, like in the illusion, or sometimes, like in the case you mentioned, I might be only able to infer using the visual information because the auditory information doesn't make any sense. But from a point of view of consciousness, whatever I perceive, whether I apprehend it correctly or incorrectly, whether it's valid or not, or even if I just hear a bunch of noise, I still experience it as something.
Yeah, but if I understood correctly, what René Descartes means, I'm conscious, therefore I am, means I'm able to apprehend something, therefore I am, no?
Well, he uses, I mean, he wrote in Latin, he uses sensu. He uses the Latin word sensu, sense. He also used, I can think about it, I can reason about it, I can think, I can sense it. So, you know, however you want to interpret that. But
so you would say that if you have two different information, and you are, depending on your degree, you are able to apprehend one information, visual information, but not the other. But you will still say that I have a conscious of the other information, auditory information.
It depends. No? While I listen to you, there's noises.
Uh-huh.
There are noises in the background, and there's a phenomenon called the cocktail party effect. In a place like this, it's very noisy. I only hear you, and I can manage because I don't pay attention to the noises in the back. I just don't hear them. I'm not conscious. I don't apprehend them. I'm not conscious of them. I'm just conscious of you. That's where attention comes in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Sindhu, I think you had a clarifying point.
Regarding the how mind and mental factors or mental events are classified, there are several different ways of doing that, one of which was presented earlier by Kusho Sangula. And the other one is classifying mind and mental event based on the functionality of the of that conscious experience. So I think that was what Keshe Pandit Agula was alluding to. whenever you have an experience or conscious experience of an object, the object appears. At the same time, that conscious experience does many things. it engages in the object. It recognizes that object. It perhaps, discriminates that object, what that object, and so on. So these are all different functions of that particular conscious experience. So based on the functionality of these different functions, we would call that one function as recognition, one function as attention, and so on. So that's another way of understanding mind and mental event. So I guess Keshe Pandit Agula was alluding to that.
I see. Thank you very much for that. I think, Brian, you've been waiting to... Oops. Oh. Ishila.
And the mental factors are the different parts of the car. And when the car stops, everything stops. So that's what I wanted to say.
And another thing that I would like to say is that and he said that definition is not important. From our point of view, it is like a passport. And the passport tells us whether and where we can tell. Second thing is that when we talk about ignorance, he said, what is ignorance? I think I will give an example of ignorance. Small case. They don't know that the fire will burn, and they don't know the causes of these physical pains. And not knowing and from them you can grow, take this to a further level, and then we can talk about the whole world, the ignorance of not knowing the interdependence.
Sindhu?
So Geshe-la gives this analogy to understand the difference between mind and mental factor. He uses the example of a car. So car would be like the consciousness or the mind, and its various parts are the mental events. So as long as the car is there, you know, all these parts needs to be there, and for the car to be functioning, all these parts needs to be functioning. So mind and mental events or mental factors are something like that. Mind is the car, and mental events are the parts that does the function of the car. And then another comment that he makes was earlier, one of the scientists say that definition may not be the most important thing. But he sees definition of anything as a certificate, so to speak. It tells whether something is that object or not. So based on the definition, we classify objects as such. So therefore, definition plays an important role. And then he also makes a comment about ignorance. If we give an example, a small child may not know the dangers of touching a live wire. So you know, the child may think that this is okay to touch, and he touches it, and then he gets the electric shock. Ignorance, in this case, the perception that the live wire is okay to be touched is ignorance. And understanding the risk of that and not touching that, or realizing that it's something that needs to be avoided, is the wisdom. So similarly, you know, as we go deeper into the nature of things, misunderstanding or misapprehending the mode of existence of object would be the ignorance, and understanding how that object exists, the mode of existence, would be the wisdom, understanding the reality.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that. And I think, Brian, you've been waiting to make a comment.
So I wanted to address what Sundu said, because I think as scientists, we have a responsibility to set the record straight in terms of why we do what we do. And so your question was, how much is it going to take? How many neurons? How many molecules, etc.? And my answer would be as many as it takes. And the reason for that is, I mean, if you look around this room, there are lots of professionals, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, Professor Lina Ting, Mike Yuvon, Dita Yeager, David McCormick, lots of people who, when we study neuroscience, we're not only studying it for the sake of knowledge, but we're studying it to, believe it or not, eliminate suffering. Mm-hmm. And so when we want to do that, we need to first understand where is the roadblock in the system. And if that means we need to know if it's 10 neurons or one neuron, then that's what we need to know. And then if we need to be able to drug something, we need to know what molecules might be involved, what pathways. And the more pathways we uncover, the more potential targets that we have. I will say that it's inconceivable, and I'd love to be corrected by anyone about this, but it's not conceivable that there's going to be a neuropsychiatric disorder or a condition that is the purview of a single neuron. So it's going to be an ensemble of neurons that fires. Fortunately or unfortunately, the brain in several respects is stochastic, so it's not the same sets of neurons that will fire repeatedly and with precision over extended periods of time, and therein lies a challenge for us to figure out what the common logic is. But I guess it'll take a lot to eliminate that suffering, and we'll do whatever it is that we can.
Point well taken. I'm aware of the time going by, and I want to make sure that we leave time for Your Holiness. I think this has been a really terrific discussion, and any comments on your part would be very welcome.
Nothing.
Well,
now,
yeah.
Now my mind mainly focusing food.
Okay. Well, time for lunch. Thank you. Thank you to our presenters. Thank you, Your Holiness.